All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
He's really got to score this one. And it's saved by Donnarumma. And Jordan Pickford really does need to produce his very best here. Otherwise, it's Italy's cup. It's Jorginho. It's Pickford's save! Jordan, teenager, Bukayo Saka, and it's saved, and Italy are the European champions.
So let's talk about, straight in, this week on the 20th episode, I start again.
You gotta start again because you clap then, I'm always doing that.
Yeah.
Doing the Macarena. Sit
that geezer, Sam. Sit that geezer. I'll show you. Remember, he makes like bear like tunes out of like just slapping himself. Like, so he's like, oh, that's sick. All right, so this week on episode 25 of the Ball Chat, so that's like a quarter of a century, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I'm proud of that. Of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast, we of course talk about the bitter disappointment of England losing to Chiellini and co. in another penalty shootout, and we give our Euro 2020 verdict as it comes to a close. We have a preview of the 149th Open at Royal St George's for you, and I give out some tips on golfers at my own peril. And to round the episode off, we have the brilliant, as usual, Mr. Allen to give us the lowdown on what happened in the UFC and boxing over the weekend. So, five things you might have missed. An Italian fan on Twitter shared a photo of his grandfather this week named Francesco, who is 101 years old and has been alive for all of Italy's successes, both in the World Cup and the European Championships. He was 14 when the first World Cup was won in 1934 and saw the wins in 1938, 1982 and 2006, along with the two European successes in 1968 and, of course, this year's at Wembley. If you make some elixir of life and keep me alive for the next 200 years, I don't think I'll be able to see that many successes for England.
He's a bit greedy, this guy, isn't he? He's hugging up all the years. His country's hugging up all the trophies. Let's just move on.
But I mean, he probably fought in the war, so...
So what, man? This is supposed to be a feel-good piece. It's just making me feel worse about what happened to England.
All right, number two. Fulham midfielder Tom Kearney is part of a consortium that are looking to develop a new social media platform that would require you to be identified when creating a user account, which would essentially take away the anonymity with which a small minority of social media users currently use as a cloak for their anti-social behaviour. The social media app is called Opon, and is slated to be released sometime this year. Jim, do you see there being a space in the social media landscape for an app of this nature?
I feel like a lot of people enjoy the anonymity that regular social media platforms afford them. So I think, although a lot of people might engage with this just on a principled kind of level, I don't see it taking off like Facebook or, you know, Twitter. Or Instagram or anything like that.
Number three, you're going to take this one.
Yeah, so President Luis Felipe Vieira has been placed under house arrest until he pays the bail of €3 million. Vieira, three other men are being investigated as part of Operation Red Card for possible fraud, money laundering and tax fraud. Defence lawyer Manuel Silva told reporters that the president of Portugal's most successful football club denies any wrongdoing, classic, and Benfica is not under investigation. The 72-year-old has run the club since 2003. Former star Rui Costa, remember him? He was club vice president, has now taken over its management. So this is kind of, it's encouraging really. I don't want to prejudge, but if I had to guess, he's probably definitely guilty, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So I think it's almost a prerequisite to own a football club, to do a bit of money laundering. So it's nice to see the system catch a big fish.
We need more owners like that that Chinese owner that like brings himself on in the 70th minute and plays his overweight son. Like, they're the real owners we want managing our football clubs, not this guy who's a bit of a dodgy Dan.
I want to see exactly where his money went. I want to see how many yachts and strippers he bought with all that cash that he squirreled away. Fair play to him. Rui Costa as well. It's the first time I've heard that name since Pro Evolution 3, I think.
Well, since he put England out of like the Euro 2004, whatever it was.
It's just never ending, isn't it?
Was that Figo? I can't remember. Oh. I'm sure he was in that team, though. All right, number four. A plethora of famous sports stars turned out for the American Century Championship over the weekend. That's a golf tournament. With big names such as Steph Curry, Justin Timberlake, Canelo Alvarez and Patrick Mahomes all in the hunt to take home a share of the $600,000 purse. After three rounds of the course at Edgewood Tahoe golf course in Nevada, former NBA coach Vinny Del Negro came in at the top spot for the competition, tallying 69 total points. MLB Hall of Fame pitcher John Smoltz and former Dallas Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo rounded off the top three.
I heard that Canelo was now a pro golfer.
He was killing it. He was sinking some like really like long birdies, man, to be fair to him.
If he's approaching golf the way he approaches boxing, he's going to be on the, he's going to have a green jacket sometime soon.
Yeah, I think worries. Steph Curry finished about, I think, tied ninth. I think Canelo was sort of 20th, 21st or something.
So Steph Curry's actually showing him levels, like.
I don't know how JT wormed his way into there. But how is he related to sport in any way?
Early 2000 pop songs and being front row at the NBA games with Cameron Diaz. This is all late 2000s pop culture knowledge.
Drake must be knocking on the door then.
He's, I'm surprised.
He's always on the Raptors, like front yeah. line. And
I'm surprised he's not in there, man. Him and J. Cole from the Boys. Yeah, definitely.
Probably was. I didn't love, but there was like just loads of NFL stars anyway. All right, number five, Jim.
Oh, I'm fuming about this one, man. Roger Federer missed the Tokyo Olympics due to a knee injury to become the latest in a series of withdrawals from the tennis, along with Team GB's Joanna Konta, Serena Williams, Rafael Nadal, and Nick Kyrgios. As a side note, spectators have been banned from most events in this year's games after Tokyo declared a fourth COVID-related state of emergency, and that's from the Irish Times. So the games might be a little bit dead this year.
I know, because I know you love tennis, because you're always throwing a little tennis gambit.
I watched the Wimbledon final before European heartbreak, and it was captivating stuff, man. Djokovic, the Serbian steel, man, he's absolutely killing it. I'm getting more and more into it. I've started watching tennis highlights now as well. So
yeah, there was a big conversation about whether Djokovic will be considered. In terms of his achievements, he will be considered the greatest of all time, but whether he should be in the same league as sort of Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer in terms of his like playing style and stuff, because people say he's a bit mechanic.
Yeah, there is definitely an aesthetic factor in consideration into how, like, Federer is so graceful. Like he's like, so, there's something classical about the way he plays. And even though he pulls off these intuitive, interpretive drop shots like through his legs, I don't know, there's just something a bit different. And then Nadal's got the old powerful backhand from his left side. And Djokovic does lack something of that movement, some of that grace. So yeah, I can see where people are coming from. But
So American golfer Billy Horschel will be seen sporting a claret and blue West Ham golf bag this week at Royal St. George's as 149th Open swings into action today. He said he became a fan after watching the blockbuster hooligan film Green Street featuring Charlie Hunnam and his bad impression of a Cockney accent, and Frodo Baggins and his bad impression of being an actor.
Oh, I mean, what more can you say about that? Charlie, that's a plethora of information you just throw my way. Yeah, that's like when you hear Tom Hanks, he's like a Villa fan or something like that. Something mad.
She's one of those weird ones. And it was. Have you ever seen the film?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, it's an absolute shocker.
I haven't. You know, when I was a kid, I thought it was a good film. The same way you think Football Factory is a good film. And if you revisit it now, you think, this is absolute tripe. But yeah.
And then you think that football... And this is a good little segue onto our next conversation, really. It's going to be the controversy surrounding the Euro 2020 final at Wembley and how sort of like England fans conducted themselves. But all these sort of like football hooligan films, they're usually just a regurgitated story based on where the football hooligan firm's from. So it'll be like Green Street, you know, the West Ham boys, and, you know, the sort of like, one will be the Chelsea boys, then one will be the Millwall boys.
Millwall are always in there. 100%.
But Millwall are always in there. Yeah, they're the one sort of like consistent factor. So we'll move on to the footy chat, and we're going to start off with the events off the field. So like a huge controversy surrounding the storming of the gates at Wembley. Multiple videos circulating on social media of fans bursting through entry points, shoving and in some case trampling stewards. There have been suggestions from certain stewards inside Wembley that there was coordination between legitimate ticket holders inside Wembley Stadium and fans waiting by fire exits ready to get in.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and some horrific reports of stewards being threatened with knives, stewards taking £300 bribes to let people in, women being sexually assaulted. It all sounds a bit post-apocalyptic in all honesty. What on earth is wrong with a very small minority of England fans? And could this have potentially been catastrophic?
What we said before in private, I think video footage aside, I'm not sure what to believe of reports like this. But yeah, I can see it all happening. I can see the knife threats happening. I can see people taking bribes. I can see the coordination definitely happening. Yeah, it's hard to say what actually happened. I do know there was a load of fired up young men trying to get into Wembley. And I know there was one video where the people inside the stadium actually took umbrage with them trying to get in, and they physically attacked the people trying to get in. So a lot of anger, a lot of...
I think the argument is like some of these people are paid upwards of £3,000 a ticket, and they're seeing people burst in.
Yeah, and then there's like 4 middle-aged men
beating up like a small kid.
Yeah, like some kicking the shit out of some lad on the floor when he's like, all right, I'm just trying to get into a football game. Don't be mad at me just because you spent all that money. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a bit, at the end of the day, look, we're all heartbroken about, and this is before the result even came in.
Exactly.
But we're all heartbroken about the result. At the end of the day, it's a game of footy, man. Do you know what I mean?
But I mean, how could this have been prevented in terms of, like, you know, controlling the sort of the populace that was around Wembley? I mean, there was a serious lack of police presence. Why the game was kept as an 8 p.m. kickoff when police knew thousands of fans would be on their way to Wembley is beyond me. And being on the source all day without tickets. Because everybody knew that, everybody could see that, because we was on the way, me, Piz, Joe, we were thinking about doing it, we were thinking about going down to Wembley, we would have been there for like 11 a.m, we definitely would have been drinking.
All day.
You know, and there's this sort of that mob culture as well, so when you see a thousand other people doing that, you think, oh, you know what, you know, I'm not saying I would have done it personally, but I'm saying how can I say?
There would have been the urge to join in.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, stewards are being paid, what, £8.60 an hour. Dealing with that nonsense is not in their pay grade. Wembley should be funding the security, but they'd rather line their pockets with the proceeds from extortionate ticket prices.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose the overall problem is that it's a culturally accepted thing here to go on the piss all day before an 8 p.m. kickoff. Now, that's really the problem. That's not going to change anytime soon. It's a natural thing that occurs to you, isn't it? Okay, if that's at 6, we'll get there for 2 and we'll just start drinking. Or if that starts at 8, we did it. And it all goes like that. So knowing that, people in charge at Wembley and the local government should have put preparations and plans in place to deal with that, man. Because I don't know if it's a resource issue or whether they just wanted things to kick off, or there's loads of different reasons why there wouldn't have been enough police there. But and I don't know how many police were, but I can surmise from reports that there weren't enough. But there were thousands and thousands of people on the streets, man. You can't really... There's not enough police to deal with them anyway.
It's crazy because West Midlands police, whenever there's a Blues Villa game, the game is always moved to a midday kickoff. So fans have not got enough time unless they start drinking at 7 a.m. In the house. And sometimes there are pubs that open very, very early.
I was just about to say, like, there's been plenty of times when I've been driving past the Blues ground at like 9 and the pubs are open and they're rammed. Yeah.
But, you know, it does mitigate those sort of problems a lot, rather than having it on the sort of, because sometimes they'd have the night games and there'd always be trouble on the night games.
But like, you know, you can't legislate for that in the international tournament, because that's an omission that people are going to behave like this. You can't say to people, oh, we want to have the final at 12 o'clock on a Sunday where you're going to get less people watching, because there's the potential for people to get drunk all day and violence.
But what was wrong with 5 p.m. on a Saturday or 5 p.m. on a Sunday?
Saturday would be the same thing. And Saturday or Sunday, it's the same thing. You haven't got work. You can just start drinking as early as you want. It doesn't matter. You're not supposed to be at work. You haven't got to pick up the kids from school. You haven't got the normal obligations of weekday life. This was going to be a problem anyway. You can't stop English people from getting hammered all day when there's a sporting event in the evening.
And it is an English cultural thing, isn't it? This wouldn't happen. I don't think this would have happened in Rome. It wouldn't have happened in Madrid. And I'm not sure.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I agree with you that we drink heavily all day. And to mass, like, have you ever, anyone who's English who spent any time drinking with people from a different country, it's always a thing, like, you drink loads compared to us.
And it's binge drinking,
and it always happens. But it's not like, the people in charge knew that. So what are they doing?
Yeah, that's the strangest thing is how there was such a lack of preparation, whether it was down to funds. You know, it looks like it's going to have an adverse effect on our bid for the World Cup in 2030, I would assume it is.
I don't know.
You know what? I remember something very, very similar happened. There was a Blues Villa game. I think it might have been the Carling Cup semi-final, which would have been in, what, 2010, 2009? But around then, anyway, there was, I think the day after, there was England going for a World Cup or a European Championship bid. Same sort of thing. I think Beckham was there. And on that night in the Blues Villa, there was like, I think the Birmingham City fans went on to the St Andrews pitch, like in their thousands, and went over to the Villa fans, and they were throwing stuff and bottles, blah, blah, blah. I think people were ripping up chairs. I think Villa fans were ripping up chairs and throwing them back onto the pitch.
Classic.
And this was the night before a World Cup bid.
Yeah.
It's in such, you know, similar circumstances as to what happened at Wembley in a slightly different manner, but it was kind of like an untimely show of a sort of like English football violence.
But it doesn't get more untimely than the final, does it? And with video evidence in it, like at least in years gone by, the involvement of camera phones wouldn't have been so complete. For like everyone's got a camera phone out and everyone's quick to start recording as well. You were going to see unpleasant scenes, and I'm just happy that no one got stabbed or anything like that, because that was like, you know.
It could have been, and you know, there could have been a stampede. People could have got, look,
there were stampedes.
I know, and it was very, it could have been a lot worse, man. Yeah. You could have potential deaths in the sort of dozens, and thank God that was avoided. But, you know, another sort of facet of this ugly nature of the way we sort of approach football and our sort of and the way we deal with defeat, and you know, are we really surprised about the racial abuse that the young English players that missed those penalties received? And what does that say about a society that, like me and you, we're not shocked at all? We could almost perceive it coming. As soon as we saw Saka go up to take that penalty, I think there was sort of thoughts in your head like, oh, what if he misses this? Because we know what English football fans are like sometimes, yeah. Don't we? A very small minority, let me put that out there.
Yeah, in a country of millions, there's always going to be a certain percentage of racists, aren't there? And you know me, you know what it's like when we're around the... I love any kind of humour that goes close to the bone, and that includes racial humour. But there's a difference between, like, having a laugh and then someone who's actually a racist. Like, if you discriminate based on the pigmentation of your skin, you're either like willfully ignorant or a bit thick on it, really. So yeah. If we're talking all jokes aside, all seriousness, there's no logical or reasonable way to be a racist. It's like you're just a plank, ain't you? Or you ignore the reality of the situation. Now, it adds to the unseemliness of it that Rashford, Sancho and Saka are also young as well. You know, it was this high-pressure situation. Like, call them bottle jobs. They're terrible at penalties. Say they're terrible footballers. Say you shouldn't be on the pitch. There's loads of...
And to be honest, Saka, in my opinion, shouldn't have been taking a penalty. He's never taken a penalty in his professional life.
Yeah, exactly.
Why on earth would you put him to take the biggest penalty of anyone's England career?
Well, we're gonna get onto that. But it's like, there are legitimate grounds on which to criticise those boys, and race ain't one of them. This is just, as you said, it's an ugly way of people dealing with defeat. Like, do you think if they were all white that they would have won the penalty shootout? Maybe not. But the deciding factor wouldn't have been a race. Not at all.
That would have been pure probability, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and people know that. So this is just, this is people thinking they've got a real reason to vent their racist thoughts. And those, like, there's no, I feel like I'm stating the obvious. Mm. But obviously I'm not stating the obvious, because people still express these thoughts online and, you know, in private, and actually mean it. They're not joking, they're not having a laugh, they're not playing their mates up or whatever. They're actually discriminating. Two completely different things.
But there is this archaic mindset from certain, you know, from a certain demographic in this country, that black people are less intelligent. Black people can't handle sort of pressure situations as well. Like, I think he's in his A levels. He's getting like all A's. He's a very, very intelligent, smart kid.
He's like that Raducanu, isn't it? He's like really young, got a professional sporting career, the likes of which none of us are ever going to achieve, and still holding down your education to a high level. He's a high performer. Do you know what I mean?
They're ultra intelligent. And don't forget what Marcus Rashford has done for so many communities, in the last like 2 years. Honestly, like that bloke has done more than any other sports person over the pandemic, feeding 200,000 kids from this country.
What a lad. And also, he sent some random kid a PS5 for no reason. Not no reason, but just as a quick one. Because it's nothing to him, is it? That's like 500 quid. That's nothing to him. And he's been like actually using his wealth, his well-earned wealth, for good means. Like, and look, he missed a penalty. He weren't a good penalty. He hit the post. He tried to be too cocky. Fine. But that's it. That's where it all ends, man. These are essentially, they seem like, obviously we don't know them. We're only exposed to their sporting personas, but they're not inherently bad because of their race. It's stupid, man.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But we're going to move on to, you know, sort of the England fans, and we're going to move to the behaviour of the England players. Only in terms of the medal. So practically every England player except Jordan Henderson and Calvin Phillips, you know, they took the runners-up medal off straight away as it was presented over their neck. You know, is this a disrespect to the game and to a disrespect to the winners, Italy?
Well, I remember the Man United players did the same thing after the Europa League final, all except Edison Cavani, the lad. I know they were heartbroken, But if I was them, I'd be hanging those medals on my hallway wall and looking at them every time I came.
Use
to the
it as motivation.
Yeah, exactly.
So like, next time, next it's going to be a gold,
exactly,
isn't it? Next
yeah,
time.
Yeah. And it, I think it was just that was kind of a reflection of how people were petulant, sore losers, really. Like, I'm not having this. Silver's not good enough. Well, silver's going to have to be good enough because you didn't win the game. So what do you want?
I think Calvin Phillips, he kissed it.
I saw that.
And I was that is what we need, man. And I tell you what, who's the first person, as all the Italy players and all the staff were sprinting over to the Italy fans to celebrate, did you see who was the only person that ran up to Saka?
No.
Calvin Phillips.
Lad.
He was the only person that initially ran up to Saka to console him.
I really like Calvin Phillips.
Honestly,
he comes across as quite a nice lad.
He's gone so far in my estimations, but he's still only 24, still got loads of time. He's going to be playing at Leeds. Hopefully he stays there, and hopefully Bielsa stays there, because I think he's turned him into a player.
He ain't going to stay at Leeds, you know.
I know, he's probably going to get picked up by one of the big clubs. But, you know, that is the kind of, you know, that is the culture and the ethic that we need to cultivate, man. What Calvin Phillips showed both in the sprinting over to Saka, and then obviously by receiving the medal. I think generally that England team has got a good culture, but I felt it did feel a bit petulant. It felt a bit childish. You know, be proud of you came.
You've got further.
We haven't been there for 55 years.
Yeah,
like, be proud of it.
And look, at the end of the day as well, we're going to go into the game in more detail. But England had it within their power until the last kick of the game. You pushed it as far as you could have possibly pushed it and still lost.
Yeah, to one penalty, that was it.
And I know that makes it even more heartbreaking, but look how close you pushed this team. That Italy team is fantastic. And I know we were hanging on for dear life by the end, but we were still there by the end. And it was anyone's game once the penalties were started taking. They should be proud of themselves. Obviously, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but there's no need for that, like, sore loser stuff, man.
And, you know, penalties is a awful way to decide who wins a European championship. Is terrible. Obviously, we had golden goal back in the day. I think back in the early 90s. Obviously, that wouldn't have made a difference because it ended up going to penalties anyway. But I was talking to a guy, an Italian fan, back in New York. And he was suggesting, I think, I'm not sure if he said it's what ice hockey do or what they used to do. But basically, you just carry on playing every sort of 5 or 10 minutes after say, 15 minutes of a lot of time.
Oh, you lose a player.
You lose a player?
Yeah.
Can you imagine that in football?
Well, I'm glad the penalties came, because if that game continued in open play, we'd have conceded
a few. We were
5 minutes. Within 5 minutes, we were going to concede a goal, because they were just slowly turning the screw on us, man. So.
Yeah, it was dangerous. But we'll go over the sort of review in general. So Italy set up in their familiar 4-3-3. England decided to revert back to the same shape that saw them conquer Germany in the last 16 by shifting Kyle Walker to right centre-back and Kieran Trippier replacing Bukayo Saka in the right wing-back role. So it was another frantic pace start to the game by England, wasn't it? And after an early misplaced pass from Slabhead led to an Italy corner, which I was thinking, well, that's not a great place to start.
I was thinking that myself, but I was hoping he was just getting the only mistake out of his system.
Yeah, and it was, to be fair. And we defended it well. Harry Kane, instead of attempting to get high and go with the Italian retreating defenders, actually just sat in a little pocket of space. One that we saw him occupying a lot this tournament and a lot for Tottenham. And he's often criticised it for in certain newspapers. Jim knows which one. He had a little scan over his shoulder and thought, hey, I'm in bags of space, yeah. Time to turn. Turn he did, and he drove into that space and played the ball out to Trippier, who had a wonderful overlapping run from Kyle Walker, which diverted the attention of the Italian defence and really sucked them in. This left room for the opposite wing-back, Luke Shaw, to just creep up into the area, and a beautifully weighted cross was met with a beautifully measured left half volley. So 1-0 England. I was kissing Pizzy in the pub. I told Southgate I was sorry about him changing to a back five, and I thought, is this actually happening?
That was some finish, you know. He did so well to keep that down and keep it straight. He was on a half bounce. The ball was spinning like mad. That was a great finish. And, you know, I was thinking, this is going to be easy. Sweet. Like, England opened them up so quickly, so decisively. That pass from Harry Kane was so perfect. I was thinking, this is going to be easy work, man.
But, you know, as the old adage goes, sometimes you can just score too early. You know, it's something that I've, you know, never really agreed with over the years. I thought, nah, that's a load of bollocks. Scoring a goal is a goal. Like, you want it. Like, if you gave every team the chance to be 1-0 up from the start, like, every team would take it. But the way I saw England's game plan pan out for the following 118 minutes made me think, maybe we did score too early. I mean, I think, you know, only once more in that footballing epoch, which it felt like, did we manage to test Gianluigi Donnarumma in the Italian net. We all had that niggling feeling that if we kept on inviting pressure from the Italians, then we would come unstuck at some point in the 90 minutes.
Yeah, stars were born and died in that game, it seemed like millions of years passed. But you know, the worst thing that happened, I think, for England was half-time. Because they looked fully capable, competent, and quite measured and controlled in that first half. I don't know what Mancini said to the Blue Boys in at half-time, but they came out like a completely different team.
Well, this is we go back to talking about Southgate being a tactical manager, and like he's been fantastic. I can take absolutely nothing away from him. So credit to him. He's got to a first final in 55 years. He's brought together a team. He's brought together a country and a nation, really, and a culture, and he's cultivated that. So, absolute credit to him. But I still don't class him as a tactical manager. And based on his substitutions over the tournament, and we'll go into this a little bit more depth later. But Mancini was the difference there at halftime. Obviously, you know, he reinvigorated his players. You know, he built the confidence. And to be honest, you don't really need to. With Chiellini and Bonucci in there, they probably would have done his halftime team talk for him. And that's the big difference between having that level of experience, that kind of acquaintance with big games and big finals. That's the massive difference.
Yeah, exactly. I think I might get a tattoo of Chiellini on me somewhere, because I think the man's a legend. Honest to God, I think he's an absolute legend, man.
Yeah, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but like, he is. He's a mammoth of a man, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's been a top level defender for 15 years. And that's like league titles, Champions League finals, that's Italian Cups, that's other European finals. That's as high grade as it gets. And he's your captain.
And we'll talk about his potential red card in a little bit as well. But Federico Chiesa was a fairly unknown quantity in the lead up to this tournament. But he has firmly imprinted himself in my memory after a couple of dazzling runs in either half that threatened us massively. But Pickford, even in the first half, after periods of sustained pressure, had yet to be properly tested. England looked fairly comfortable. They looked fairly comfortable, but to defend for 90 minutes against a team with the quality and know-how of the Italians was always going to be a monumental task. Second half, the Italians really started to turn the screw. They started to dominate possession. I think this is where England needed to be a little bit more positive. Always easy to say in hindsight, because if I was Gareth Southgate and I was 45 minutes away from leading my team to victory, we've only conceded one goal in the whole tournament, then I probably would have done exactly the same. England did end up finishing the tournament without conceding a single goal from open play, which is truly remarkable, and credit to them.
That's a solid point. Like, I didn't feel, in the first half at least, I didn't feel like Italy were any closer to breaking England down than any other team had been. So if you're Southgate in that scenario, you might just be saying, look, just carry on doing what you're doing. Trust in the process, trust in your defender, because England were, they're an outrageously good defensive team when you think about it.
Yeah.
In the second half, we couldn't even get the ball off them. There wasn't even an opportunity to be more positive, because they had the ball. They were like playing in triangles. Then you got like Insigne. Then you got Chiesa doing this. They would go into free roles, then go back into their position. Then another player would go into a free role, and it's like, what is happening here?
Yeah, like, just like fluid positional sort of rotation, stuff like that.
And it was all natural. There was no hesitation. And then England were really penned into this defensive mindset. And then you just basically holding on. Then, aren't you?
It's hard to get out of it as well. Once you're in it, and that comes with the idea of like scoring too early, is like, you think, especially in a final, in a game of that magnitude, you think, right, we've got the advantage now. Let's just hold it. It's something Jose Mourinho would do. Potentially, Jose Mourinho would get a win out of that, though. If you give Jose Mourinho a 1-0 lead in the final, he usually holds on to it, man. Yeah. Like, to be fair, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the tactical instructions that he gives to certain players. But I thought, generally, England defended fairly well. I think, you know, sort of Chiesa did cause us quite a lot of problems. But then let's obviously talk about the goal. I mean, Pickford made a great diving low save to his left-hand side from a mazy Chiesa run. And then England were sort of like conceding the lion's shares of possession, but still looked dangerous from set pieces, as we've done the whole tournament. But it was the Azzurri who finally managed to capitalise on a well-worked set piece in the 67th minute. So Kieran Trippier found himself in a one-on-one mismatch like near the front post with Brian Cristante, who came on for the Italians. He looked about a foot taller than him. So that was a massive mismatch. And it was the Italian who got the flick on, which diverted the ball towards back post. Verratti got in ahead of Kyle Walker. And another great save from Pickford, who I think was our player of the match by a country mile. And it unfortunately rebounded off the post into the path of Bonucci, who had the simple task of rolling into corner.
You know what? My dad was doing my head in when this goal went in. He's like, the keeper should have done better there. He's like, he should have punched it away, he should have caught it. I was like, Dad, are you watching this game? Have you watched the way that's just unfolded? He couldn't have done more. He couldn't have done more.
He nearly made one of the saves of his life.
He did make the save, though.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
He just unlucky that he came off the post and came inside, not outside. Yeah.
It was a matter of inches, and I was trying. I wanted to strangle my dad when he was
That's what you get, like when you're in a pub, or sometimes you're having conversations with people that aren't football fans for the majority of the year. You do get that a lot, but that's what I love about international tournaments, is they bring people that wouldn't necessarily watch football all the time, and it's sort of like, you know, it really gets them involved in the game, and you know, it gives them this fairy tale. So I was talking to like people from some old university friends, girls who I'd never spoken to football about before, and they were like, oh, did you watch the game? I had this bet.
Yeah, India's mum was watching it. My mum was watching it. I was thinking, this is mad. This is like everyone's on the foot.
She was like, oh, I had a bet on Italy to win on penalties. I was like, oh, you dirty dog.
My dad had that bet.
Yeah.
I was thinking, this is a good thing for you.
I had either team to win on penalties, so at least, I was kind of like, I don't care which one. Nah, I did, but I think going back to that goal, I think Italy may have had a potential penalty shout, even if that ball had not gone in. Did you see John Stones? He was all over Chiellini. He was dragging him to the ground, because obviously Chiellini, the wily old fox, was like trying to get on the end of a flick on.
Go on, Stonesy boy.
But he was all over him. But I think there could have been a penalty shot had that not gone in. But you know, I think this is at this time when we conceded that goal, it was like, this is when we needed the support of the England fans. And I've seen multiple people claim we have the best fans in the world, but you could hear a pin drop in Wembley Stadium from that point on. Moans and groans when there was misplaced passes or shots dragged wide. You know, this just played into the Italians' hands, and they took the initiative for the rest of the game, as we resorted to taking our chances from set pieces and even long throws in extra time. Do you see the long throws?
But I thought there was kind of a method to that, because you do just need to when you get the ball into the box and it's bouncing, anything can happen. So you want to create that kind of chaos. I didn't have a problem with the long throws.
But you look at what we did at the end of the Denmark game when we held the ball for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Where was that confidence? Where was that desire to possess and to break Italy down?
You can't just manifest that confidence. Like, they're a goal up, they're inches away from the final, and they are quite good at retaining the ball. But here, the pressure is times 10, times 20, times 100.
Yeah, but it comes down to the instructions and the directives that came from the head coach. And the head coach obviously did not say to try and possess the ball whenever on the pitch. And so there's a big difference there. Yeah. I think we've deliberately sort of said, these are a really good team. We've shown them too much respect in that second half, I think.
Yeah, I think so as well, to be fair. But the pressing was different as well from Italy. They're better organised defensively, and they know how to aggressively nip away at players without giving away too many fouls. And even though they gave away a lot of fouls in the game, there weren't that many yellow cards. They know how to really ride that line between a foul and a tackle. And it unsettled a lot of the English players, I think.
And you know what they did? They did exactly what Spain did to them in the semi-final. So Italy went ahead quite early against Spain. Spain dominated possession. They kept on turning the screw, and then Spain scored late. It was kind of in the same formula as what happened with the England game. They just did the reverse. Because
they
knew that they could probably possess the ball better than us. Penetrate a little bit better. And, you know, Chiesa, Insigne, I don't think had an amazing game, but he was still there. He's still a threat. He's still built with the ball. Verratti and Jorginho have been like brilliant all tournament.
Emerson was sick as well.
Emerson, man. Yeah, fair play to him, considering he's had no football this season.
Yeah,
and that's only his, I think he's only his second or third start for Italy since Spinazzola got injured. But, you know, let's talk about the dreaded penalties. So, firstly, like, how surprised were you to see Slabhead step up? And not just step up, stick it in the top corner.
I wasn't surprised to see him step up. I was surprised to see him go top bins, man. 200 mil all day long. He's the best defender in history, except for Chiellini, I reckon.
Worth every penny.
Yeah. Bargain for
After just a few months ago, we were saying that 80 million was outrageous for a defender. But
what a difference a tournament makes, man.
And it. Do you think Southgate completely overthought the prospect of penalties? Should he have shown a little bit more tactical nous during the game rather than saving two subs to take penalties when coming on cold? So this was the argument. And of course, the argument's going to be, why did he waste substitutions when both those players missed that he brought on, Sancho and Rashford? But I think his tactical substitutions throughout the tournament have been pretty mundane, pretty predictable, like-for-like substitutions on the 70th minute. like-for-like substitutions in the 90th or the 99th minute when he's bringing Grealish on, stuff like that, like when he hasn't got enough time to have an impact on the game. Like, what do you think about this?
Well, he's quite rigid, isn't he, in terms of how he makes his defensive changes. He's not a guy who's going to switch up the team mid-game. Like, I think at the beginning of the game, he set up the team as best he could, and I think that showed in the first half performance. But I feel as early as the 60th minute, England were hanging on for dear life. And I don't think a substitution like the one he made, taking off Declan Rice, who was unbelievable,
yeah,
immense in the middle of the park. As far as I'm aware, he wasn't injured. Why take him off for Jordan Henderson in that position? Like, what in that position in the game? Why do that? And Hendo was misplacing passes all day. He doesn't add an extra element of pace. His passing game wasn't on point. So you haven't got like that extra dynamic to the game. And also, Harry Kane's not running in behind. Sterling's not running in behind because the Italians have got him on absolute lockdown.
We knew there was going to be no space. Yeah. And to be honest, in a 4-3-3, in that setup, the players like Sterling and Saka and Sancho, Rashford, any players that play in those sort of wide areas, Grealish, like they have sort of like outlets, you know what I mean? And they have a lot more space by nature of the way the system's set up. They'll start out wide, they can receive the ball, they've got time to receive, and then they've got time to take a touch, a positive touch, and like drive at players. You don't really get that in the system that we had, because obviously Luke Shaw and Kieran Trippier were sort of, they're responsible for getting up and down that wing. So they're responsible for doing all of that job, all up and down those wings. So that means that naturally, Sterling and Mason Mount are a little bit more compact and they're playing a little bit more centrally, which makes it a lot tougher to try and build. Like, especially when you've got sort of like Jorginho, Verratti, Barella, Chiellini, and all those Bonucci, all those great players in that middle of the field, it's hard to build.
And bearing that in mind, why would you bring on Jack Grealish in like what was the minute?
I think it was 99th.
99th minute,
and then 20 minutes,
and then bring on like, okay, Grealish is a player who, as we spoke about last week, can potentially work in closer confinement than say Sterling or say Saka when he came on or whatever. And it's just like, he wasn't, I don't want to say that he was too conservative or that he was scared or timid or anything like that. He wasn't willing to fail gloriously, was he? He wasn't willing to switch everything up. I mean, for me, I think Harry Kane's got to come off after an hour, because I know he was tremendous in the first half, but even at the end of the first half, he was looking tired.
Yeah.
And he didn't contribute much for the rest of the game either. I know
He always needs to be on to take a penalty, though, didn't he? He's our best penalty taker. So I think there was always that in the back of the mind.
But think of Declan Rice is West Ham's penalty taker.
The thing is, you could have took him off after 75 minutes and you could have brought him back on. There was no saying what you know, with the six subs nowadays, like, you can do whatever you want, basically.
That's
like,
a bit mad, isn't
it? You could have took him off, but say Dominic Calvert-Lewin on, who's got pace, got strength, can hold up the ball, good in the air, can hit shots from inside and outside the box. Could have brought him on, gave him 35, 40 minutes, and then brought Harry Kane back on for the penalties.
That would have been the move, man. And to be again,
he wasn't brave with his substitutions. That is the criticism. Yeah. He wasn't brave with his substitutions. He wasn't brave with switching it up tactically. And I'm not saying that contributed to us not winning, because we still could have won it. But I'm just saying there was potential there to do things differently in a more positive way.
Yeah. And I think the main criticism you have to level at him is that when he brought Sancho and Rashford on, 5 minutes before, they're sitting on the bench, cold as anything. Next thing you know, they're stepping up to take penalties, deciding penalties as well. That's not good.
And it's not good to, you know, mentally get stimulated into the game. Like, how do you? I don't understand how you could ask any person, let alone a footballer or any person in any profession. Right, you haven't done a job for the last 6 weeks. Now I want you to go and do the best job out of anybody. Mm-hmm. I haven't put any trust in you to go on the field and score goals or, you know, contribute to the team. But now you need to contribute to the team. You need to go and
win this trophy for us, which is an unreasonable expectation to have. And, you know, I had a bad feeling. I know we were saying this in the France game with Mbappe and all that. But when Rashford stepped up, I had a really bad feeling. There wasn't a drop of sweat on him. Do you know what I mean? It's like when a boxer comes out to the ring cold. And it's like, they're going to get chinned. Like, do you know what I mean? And it was like that.
Can you imagine the odds on, say, you know, two great fighters, let's say, you know, like, Pacquiao versus Canelo, both in their prime. Like, you put them together. Oh, you give one guy four practice rounds and one guy going in cold. Who are you going to bet on?
Exactly, and it would be a massive factor in who you decide on who's going to win. And even then, Rashford still sent the best keeper in the tournament the wrong way. with his just general body language.
Yeah.
And it's because their keeper is so immense. He's like 7 foot tall and he's like a cat as well. Like he gets across, he covers that space. You have to send him the wrong way. Rashford managed to do that and he just tried to be a bit too precise with it.
Like. I mean, look, he's a fantastic penalty taker, Rashford is. So why not bring him on and give him extra time? For Sterling?
Yeah.
Bring him on for Sterling. Play two up front.
Or Kane. Or even Kane, man.
Yeah.
Like, just to give him that space in the middle. I was calling for Rashford to be substituted on for many games throughout the tournament because I think he's... I know he's had a bad season. I know that. But I think from what the glimpses that I've seen of him, he can be a spectacular player, man. And yeah. I'm not expecting him to bring out his best form in these games, but he adds a different element. Say with Calvert-Lewin, man, he never got a sniff the whole tournament.
I think he played 20-odd minutes. I think he came on for 20-odd minutes against, was it Denmark or something like that?
Man, this guy has been formidable all year. So even if you don't want to bring on Rashford, that's fair. I can understand the argument there. But why not bring on Calvert-Lewin? Mm. He's been dominating lads in the air all season.
I think really showing he ended up getting, what, 100-odd minutes. So, you know... But if we would have won that tournament, would we have still criticised him? Potentially. I think potentially.
I think we would have, because we would have been rolling a right. That Rice for Henderson substitution will baffle me to the end of my days. I don't know what he's thinking there. Why compromise that defensive layer when we've got three at the back? Why do that?
Yeah.
Henderson's
strange.
Not that guy getting mixed in tackling people.
And he didn't take a penalty either. Somebody, the most experienced bloke in the England team. Yeah, and he didn't take penalty.
That's a good point. So why, like what Roy Keane said, isn't it? What is it? Why do they like him around there? Do you do card tricks or something like
yeah,
that?
Isn't it?
Why
yeah,
are
yeah.
you there?
If he's not there to show a calm, experienced head in times like that and
leadership.
let a 19-year-old lad who's never taken a penalty before, whose knees must have been like knocking against each other because his coach has entrusted him with this monumental task of beating Donnarumma, who's about 8 foot in the goal, one of the best keepers in the world at 22, has had like 200 appearances for AC Milan, and you're asking this 19-year-old lad to beat him.
Saved the pen.
Already saved the penalty. Yeah. Why on earth is Sterling, Grealish, Henderson allowing him to like walk up and you know?
But the thing, I understand that argument and I agree with it, but I also think that if you're man enough to be on the pitch, if you volunteer for a penalty, if you say yes. That's on you, man. And, you know, I know he's young. I know that. And I've got a lot of sympathy for him, especially in light of people's reactions.
But we don't even know if he's... Because Southgate clearly picked these penalty takers before the game. So, like, they knew what their penalty taking strategy was going to be at the start of the game. So this was all planned. So nobody in the England staff and nobody in this country would have begrudged Henderson snatching the ball off Saka and saying, look, lad.
You'd have been like, fair play. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, look, lad, you know, this is too big of a task for you. Like, if I miss, then I'll take it. Yeah. We would have been like, that's a leader. That's what he's there for.
Yeah.
Where was he? Where was he in those moments?
I'm feeling, the more we talk about this, I'm feeling like more...
Worried about the culture. Well,
first and foremost, I'm impressed by Saka putting himself in that position. Like he's a kid. Do you know what I mean? And to even step up and do that, like fair play to him, man. But it is his responsibility to score the goal. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to alleviate all responsibility from him because of his age. Do you know what I mean? He's a professional footballer. There is a you should. No, I'm not saying you should.
Yeah, I know.
Score,
but the kid's just finished his A levels, like,
yeah.
And then he's got the weight of a nation.
Yeah, I agree.
55 yeah. years of weight and hurt and disappointment on his shoulders, like dragging on him like a lion claws to a wildebeest. Can you imagine? Like that's what he must have felt like walking up to that penalty spot.
I would have certainly preferred to see Henderson, Grealish, Phillips, even John Stones. Any of those
somebody players. Take the ball off him, man.
A more senior player. And you know what, I think in the end, Southgate and a lot of those senior players really shied away from the occasion and Saka stepped up. So fair play to him, man.
Yeah.
He didn't miss. The shot was saved. Do you know
what
I mean?
All credit goes to Saka, but somebody of experience in that England team should have made a better decision. But we'll move on to Pickford. Like, let's talk about Pickford because credit to him in that shootout. He faced up against Jorginho, who I think had never missed a penalty prior to that in his career, with the prospect of losing the title on the line. Read his penalty perfectly and gave us a lifeline. And did you see his he was miming we was trying to read what he was saying. He was saying no problem.
Yeah, I remember.
You know what I mean? Like he was like, nah, no problem.
He's like hitting himself in the chest, looking at the ball, looking at the floor, going, no problem. This is straight. This is all this is within this is easy work for me. And that is
England's number one.
Just start him now. Don't even bring other keepers into the conversation unless he's injured, because he tipped it onto the post, didn't he? You know what I mean? And then caught the rebound as well. So come on, man. This is outrageous. And then I'm thinking, all right, now we're going to win. And it was so emotional, like going up and down, stressing my dog out. Oh, I was jumping around the living room, screaming. Like.
But I just wanted to make a quick mention of, because we were talking about Southgate and Mancini and the sort of their use of their squads. Unless I'm wrong, I think Mancini used every single person in his squad at least once. Even Sirigu and whoever their third choice goalkeeper, they got minutes. Every single player in their squad got minutes.
If you've got the opportunity to make extra substitutions, why wouldn't you take advantage of that? It's a bit mad. I think especially with Kane, it was the most notable or noticeable. Just the fatigue, man. I know he's carrying a long season on his back, you know, but at least like take him off after 60.
It's the mental fatigue as well, playing these huge games, man. And then the expectation on you and stuff like that.
And if you see another player come in and absolutely done it, then you might be like, all right, I better get my act together now. That might energise you as well, create that a little bit of element of competition within the team. But again, it's your captain as well. I think that has had a lot to play in it. I don't think he wanted to, as a symbol, I think he didn't want to take Harry Kane off as if to show support to him. But you could see it, man. Every step was an effort. Before like 75 minutes, he was dog tired, man. So.
Like, imagine if we would have took Trent Alexander-Arnold as well. Like, obviously, he got injured. He probably was going to be there, but... You know, Ben Chilwell didn't get any minutes. Connor Cody didn't get any minutes. Ben White didn't get any minutes. You know, then you got a plethora of players that didn't get, like, barely got any. Like, Sancho barely. Rashford barely. Dominic Calvert-Lewin barely. Bellingham probably got, like, about, what, 50 minutes? A couple here and there. So, generally, there was no real confidence in the squad as a whole. He did have his players that he trusted in it, and then he just set in with them.
That's something that he might... examine going forward, and I've heard him say stuff like, "I don't want to outstay my welcome as England manager." But it's like, mate, you're the best one in a long time, so don't shy away now because you're disappointed or you're heartbroken or you're scared of what people are going to say. Take it on the chin, be the leader we wanted you to be in this tournament. Take that attitude with you next year, be more adventurous. Take players, if you don't trust these players, don't name them in the squad. Bring players who you're happy to put on the pitch at any time, man. Yep. And be brave enough to make those decisions at pivotal moments, and then you're going to ascend to like immortality, man. I've got a lot of hope for Gareth Southgate. I think he's the type of guy who learns from his mistakes, and I think next year in the World Cup, if we make it, do we have to do qualification this year?
Qualify for Qatar, I think it's a real quick one.
As long as we qualify, I think we're going to see a little bit more from him, and I would hope we see a little bit more.
Hopefully. Take like what Mancini did with his squad this tournament, because they ended up winning it, and they ended up, you know, giving a lot of players a lot of minutes. So take what he did. I mean, even, I think, their three strikers, their three main target men, Immobile, Berardi, and
Belotti.
They all played six games each. How did he work in?
I don't know, but that Belotti seemed to come on every game at about 70-ish minutes, something like that.
But he still come on every game.
Yeah.
He still took Immobile, who's their target man, who's the player that scored all the goals, you know, for them and in his club side. You know, he still took him off every game.
That's what I'd like to see from Southgate, to save Kane and to give the other player minutes to just. It's just better, isn't it, if everyone's playing? You've got faith in all the players, you're resting this player, it's just better.
And then perhaps when you come to penalties in the final, after you've played Marcus Rashford six times in the tournament, he doesn't come on quaking in his boots thinking, oh, he hasn't given me a chance all tournament, now he's asking me to do this. Perhaps when he's played six games, he comes on and goes, I'm going to fucking stick this top corner.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all ifs and buts, isn't it? But, like, I think there is a clear way for Southgate to...
Improve
and ingratiate himself back into the favour of English fans. But to be fair, I don't think people have really turned on him. I think they've really been focusing on the penalty, the ones who missed the penalties.
Which is outrageous. Yeah. I just wanted to quickly talk about the Euro shootout data. And I saw this and I thought this was really interesting. So there's been four penalty shootouts in this tournament, which is 38 penalties taken, 24 scored and 14 missed, which is a conversion rate of 63.2%. But the most interesting thing is the conversion by position and conversion by age. So out of the defenders, 5 out of 7 scored. So 5 defenders out of the 7 that taken. That's a 71%. 71.4%. Midfielders, half of them, 50%, so 6 out of 12 scored. and forwards 13 out of 19. So a lot more forwards taking penalties, which is to be expected. But look at that conversion rate from defenders.
I think that was a lot of that was in the Switzerland-France shootout as well, wasn't it? Because they had their centre-backs just
and obviously
straight up.
Bonucci, Maguire. There's two there in it. I can't think on the Italian side if there's any more defenders. But this is the most interesting conversion by age. So 30 plus, 7 out of 8 penalty takers. 87.5% of players 30 or older score their penalties. 24 to 29 year olds, 16 out of 22 players, 72.8%. And 23 and under, remarkably, only 1 out of 8 penalty takers, 12.5%.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
It does make sense.
It's a composure thing, it's a pressure thing, it's an experience thing. Like, all these lads have the technical ability to score a penalty. That's not what penalties are about. Penalties are about holding your nerve.
It's game theory, ain't it, penalty? It comes down to, as you say, like bottle. Like, it's something that we talk about in football and talk about in sports. It's not measurable, is it, bottle? Yeah. But it's just something that you need. Like, and I think one of the people in that team that had the biggest bottle was probably Jack Grealish, man.
Yeah.
I don't care if he hasn't took a penalty for two years.
He does not shy away from the big occasion.
Nah, so fucking give him a penalty then.
But it's easy saying that, man. Do you know what I mean? Look, think about Rashford. Rashford's penalty is like kind of encapsulates the whole situation for me. Because look how confident that penalty was. He was 3 inches to the left of where he should have been.
Yeah.
And if he went 3 inches to the right, that was in off the inside of the post and in. And that's the best penalty you've ever seen. And all of a sudden, momentum's with England. All of a sudden, Jadon Sancho's not as tight. When he does that little
not
flick.
As much pressure,
When he does that horrible little flick with his feet and then try to put it to the right side of the goal. It's like
they all did the start step, England players.
Horrible.
I don't get it. I understand doing it at the start of your run-up and then taking one or two strides and then hitting it. But Sancho and Rashford, they do theirs just before they kick the ball, which surely takes any kind of power and impetus that's swinging from your leg into the ball. Surely it takes away that. I'd rather a player like generate more power, you know, than placement at times. Because sometimes if you hit that penalty hard, sometimes, like for example, the Bonucci one, where sort of Pickford guessed right, but Bonucci went a bit high. But I think because he had that generated that power, you know, Pickford couldn't get near it. So
that late stutter step relies entirely on misdirection. You know what I mean? If the keeper goes the right way, he's probably going to get it. But like you say, if you drill it, you don't want to go full Stuart Pearce and put it like in the car park.
Yeah.
But put some kind of pace on it. And I saw the replay with Rashford. He weren't even looking at the ball when he hit it, man. Mm. He was entirely trying to read the keeper's reactions or predict where he was going to go.
So he probably mishit it slightly.
And he guessed right. This is the mad thing. He put it in the right and it was just a matter of inches. That could have changed everything.
You know, sort of Saka's and Sancho's penalties were both at a nice height, not in the corner. Obviously, Donnarumma's like a log. Is that long?
Yeah,
so, you know, he's going to get anything.
There,
it has to be in the corner. If you're going to hit it low, like hit it low or hit it high.
Kane's penalty was bad boy, you know.
Yeah. And Maguire's were just loud as well. Yeah. But I'd imagine that one player that converted, I wouldn't be surprised if it's Pedri. I'm not sure who it is, but the one out of eight, the under 23s that converted was probably Pedri. So there you go. There's the argument. He's, you know, a player like him.
Put the old boys in to take the penalties.
Put the old heads. If Gareth Southgate would have seen that data, I know it's easy because obviously we've got one of the shootouts has massively contributed in the favour that we're sort of like backing. Because obviously three of the players that were under 23 missed for us. So they've contributed massively towards that data. But if he would have saw that even before that penalty shootout, he probably would have thought, maybe I should give like one of the old heads, a few more of the old heads penalties. But
hindsight as well, isn't it?
Yeah, hindsight's a beautiful thing. So we'll quickly go over the player ratings for both teams and then we'll go over our sort of best 11 for the tournament. So we're coming to the end of the Euro talk for a few years.
Yeah, it's been a good ride, man. And I'm happy that we were able to experience it up until the final, because usually we just get to the quarters, we go out in the same manner, and then we have to watch the rest of the tournament just with this underlying feeling of distaste. And we didn't have that this time.
So and you lose the interest. But yeah, like, you know, let's hope England get further and deeper into these tournaments like more often, because it does, you know, it does generate a buzz around the country and, you know, keeps us all involved. But that's kind of selfish because I'm sure every other country is probably thinking the same thing. So we'll go over the player rating. So I'll give Pickford a 9. I don't think you can argue with that.
He's, not at all.
His performance in the game and then his performance in the penalty shootout, you know, really sort of thrust him into the conversation of like best keeper in the tournament. So, you know, although Donnarumma ended up getting that accolade. But Kieran Trippier, 7.
Fair enough. I mean, especially earlier in the game. A lot of these scores, I think, yeah, early in the game, sweet. And then it was just, the more the game went on, the more the Italians came on, and
so. I think defensively, we were pretty good. So I didn't give any of our defensive players less than a 6. Obviously, I went Maguire with an 8. I think just commanding again.
Yeah, unreal.
Some great range of passing after he got that sort of like early terrible pass out of the way.
Yeah, he really did get it out of his system, didn't he? And after that, he was sweet. So
John Stones 7, I think, in the shadow of Maguire again. But John Stones been there, you know, ever present. Didn't concede one goal from open play, which is incredible. Walkov gave us 6, and you put interest in that.
Yeah, like what made you downgrade him from, you know,
average 7. Yeah. I think he did get beat on a couple of times by Chiesa going to ground. I think he, and you know, there's been a lot of people have put him in their team, you know, as a right back. They put him in their sort of like team of the tournament. I think he's had a very consistent, good tournament, and he's been part of like a very solid England backline, obviously playing as a right back and then playing as a right centre back as well. But, you know, I don't think he's been miraculous. Like, he's got no goals or assists, which some right backs and some wing backs have contributed to their team. Like, Joakim Mela, who you're going to see, who I'd put as my right wing back, I think he had 2 assists and a goal, contributed to, he was involved in 25% of Denmark's goals, and he played well defensively. So that's kind of the reason. I think in the modern game, as a fullback, you need to contribute to both, you know, both phases of the game. So that's not why I've given him a 6 in this instance. I think he also got beat on the back post by Verratti for the goal.
Okay.
So they're just a couple of things that I picked up.
I remember seeing him. I remember he got beat by Chiesa. I think he was on the left flank. I remember thinking that's the first rash thing I've seen him do this whole tournament. And then Italy were in, and I was like, oh, you can't be doing that now, man. So yeah, I understand why you've put in 6.
Yeah, so it's just because they're the couple of moments that stuck out in my mind. Shaw, I gave him an 8.
Yeah.
Fantastic goal. I think defensively was solid again. Constantly tried to, in the first half more than the second. He didn't really get forward enough. No one got forward enough in the second half. Rice and Phillips, both 7.5. They could become a household name. I wouldn't be surprised if we see some like sort of
big money moves for them to you want them in the middle of the park. Yeah, they're outstanding, and I think Phillips was done a little bit of a disservice when Bryce was taken off, because I think those two working in tandem together are really effective, and when Henderson came on, it just disintegrated a little bit. So
only one person covered more ground than Phillips in the whole tournament. That was Jorginho. He covered like 86.5 kilometers or something, or miles.
Yeah, he was putting in some mad, and you know, I think I said it before, his adventurous passing was some of like the only glimmers of hope we saw in the second half. You know, when he was trying to get the ball forward, when he was trying to ping it, like trying to spread the play, and it just didn't work out against a fucking world class team, innit?
Sterling and Mount of both give 5s, and people, obviously we were saying like Mason Mount, like before the game we were saying like, you know, What is Southgate seeing him? What do sort of you know? Obviously, Chelsea fans see a lot more of him than we do. But is he? You know, do we really see enough from him to say like he's a player good enough to start for England? And now a European Championship final team, is he good enough to be there?
I've seen more from Jack Grealish in his cameo appearances than I have seen from Mount in his, like, he's played full games. Was it just after the Scotland game where he had COVID?
I think in this game he came off. Did he come? Grealish came on for him, didn't he? In the 99th minute. But it goes back to the like for like.
Yeah.
Southgate, he's very loath to change positions, put personnel in different positions. He seems to only want to do like for like.
Mount's not the one for me anyway. He doesn't have that extra bit of creative flair that you can expect from Grealish. He doesn't commit players. He's just a bog standard player for me, man. At least in this tournament, I can't speak for him.
I think ironically, he probably had his best 45 minutes in the first half, but then I think second half he probably was pretty ineffectual. I wouldn't say anonymous. I was reading some pretty harsh, I think it was the Daily Mail, that were giving some pretty harsh reviews of the England players, but I think ineffectual, definitely. They just couldn't get him into the game. Same as Kane. I've given Kane a 6. I've slightly bumped him up just for his role
In the goal,
pretty much. And then subs, Grealish gave a 5, just didn't have enough time to get into the game. Saka didn't see enough from him when he came on, and Henderson a 5 as well.
I thought Henderson was shite, absolutely shite. He was trying some mad outside of the foot passing, trying to just kicking the ball out of play, trying to be needlessly adventurous. When you do want him to be daring, but when there's no one there, what are you trying, man?
Yeah,
like,
We didn't need him to come on and be Pirlo, did we? That obviously wasn't in that wasn't in the game plan. It was to probably come on and do Declan Rice's job.
Yeah, which he's not fit for, really. Not fit either in terms of how he approaches the game, and not fit physically as well. So.
And then as a managerial rating, I give Southgate 5. He has to be criticised for the way he handled the substitutions. He brought on Grealish too late. Rashford and Sancho were poor substitutions because they ended up missing the penalties.
And too late again.
So really, which one of his subs had an effect on the game?
None of them.
So he's had a great tournament and he's got a lot of things right, Southgate has, but he did not get this final right at all.
Which is unfortunate, but you know, onwards and upwards. That's not a mark for him and the tournament as a whole, but he did. He shied away from it a little bit in the final.
Yeah, all right, and we'll race through the Italian rating. So Donnarumma, 8. Solid. I think he's been solid throughout the whole tournament. Di Lorenzo, the Italian right-back, I give a 6. I think Luke Shaw caused him quite a lot of trouble early on and in the first half, but then he didn't really have much to do for the rest of it. Bonucci and Chiellini, I've just both given 9. I think just imperious.
Thug life, man. Them two were absolutely killing it. They were unreal.
And those talking about that Chiellini challenge on Saka being a red card, watch a bit more football. Because it's not a red card. It's a yellow card every day of the week. It always has been. It always will be.
When I saw that straight away, I was like, that was a darn move, you know. I think he made that challenge. And for anyone who didn't see it, Saka's beat him on the halfway line.
It's his first. He's killing his first mistake of the tournament. Yeah. He's thought he could shield the ball. Saka's got too much pace and too much physicality, which he's shown throughout the tournament.
Yeah.
And he's nipped around him.
Then Chiellini's grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and just dashed him on the floor. And I was thinking, he made that decision thinking a red's a possibility here. That's what's been going on this tournament. The officiating's been really dodgy. I think he made that decision accepting that. And that's what you want from your captain. Do you know what I mean?
That's what he's took a yellow for the team. But because he didn't want Saka going through one-on-one against Bonucci.
Yeah. The timing of it as well, it was really like late in the game. And he was thinking, I'm not letting Saka, he's not going past me.
I think it was the 90th minute. I think it was just before extra time.
Yeah, yeah. So there you go, man. Absolutely crucial. That's leadership quality, that is.
But there's a great photo that I saw on Twitter. I'll show it you now. It's I'll just describe it. It's like Chiellini with Mancini, and Chiellini's holding the trophy in one hand, and he's holding Saka in the other hand.
That is jokes.
So might put that on the Instagram because that is absolutely hilarious. He's just a leader, like it's one of those leader decisions, and we talked about game management and Italy's ability to just like find ways to win. That was an example of it. Emerson, I think you were pretty impressed with him. So, I'll give him a 7. Maybe you probably bump up to a 7.5 because I think you was impressed with him.
He was just everywhere and he was nipping at players. I think, did he get a yellow card as well, didn't he?
Potentially,
he was here, there and everywhere. And even though he wasn't doing anything fantastic on the ball, he was just causing England problems in the middle of the park all day long. So yeah, 7.5, happy.
And then midfield, Jorginho and Verratti, I think both give them an 8. They stuck out more in my mind than their midfield counterpart Barea, who I give a 6. I can't remember too much from him. Jorginho and Verratti just controlling possession. Jorginho again, like, fantastic, always in the right place at the right time, just making the team tick. Chiesa a 9. I don't think anyone can agree with that. He looked a constant threat.
I can't believe he's only just come to light during this tournament.
I'd never heard of him.
I've never heard of him.
Yeah, he's playing for Juventus. Juventus, I think, have had a really bad season. I think they finished like 4th or something. They just about scraped in Champions League. But he's been incredible, man.
He does not care how much he runs, does he? It's always him just sprinting towards the ball, pressing up high, dribbling with the ball, in and out. These amazing runs.
He's kind of their Sterling. Like, he's their version of Sterling. And he'll pick up the ball in these little pockets of space, get in between the lines and the midfielders, just turn, just drive at players, and he looks so dangerous. And he's got a great finish on him. Insigne, I give a 7. I think not one of his best games, but he's still contributing in terms of like helping Italy build through the first.
I think England were very aware of him. Like, any time he got on the board, they were like, let's shut this down.
So I think they had a game plan for him, definitely. And then Immobile at 5. He was just kind of...
Yeah, he was the only player where I was thinking... Nah,
he didn't really link up. He didn't really link up with his teammates. So I think that probably contributed to them not really being able to, you know, have many chances from open play. Obviously, Chiesa had the sort of like lion's share of them. They did have a few set piece opportunities. I think Insigne had one that just went over the bar. But look, their subs. They made subs at the right time. Mancini didn't bring on players just to take penalties. He entrusted the players that he put on the field to take penalties. Cristante, 7 involved in the goal. Belotti and Berardi both getting on. I think probably one of them playing that central position, maybe Belotti playing for Immobile, and I think Berardi came on for Insigne. Bernadeschi midfield and Locatelli midfielders, I imagine they came on for Barella and Verratti. So they've even got the sort of, you know, he's even got the courage to take off a player like Verratti, who I've ended up putting in my
Euro 11. You smashed it, like, yeah. And just for energy's sake, you know, just to disrupt things a little bit more, just to put, because you can see, if we can see it, Mancini can see it, how tired England were getting. He's like, let's just get fresh legs on him now. Let's just put it on him. Let's put it on him even more. Let's put him more in that defensive shell. Let's see if we can crack him.
And he's clearly got no qualms with taking his big names off.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something you want, isn't it, from a manager. That's the first thing you want from a manager, really.
So I'll give Mancini an 8.
Yep.
So a 3-point markup from Southgate, just because tactically, you know, he probably did get it right, but obviously he had to deal with the early goal. But as we've spoken before, like, Mancini, I think, will be regarded one of the best coaches of all time when it comes to the end of his career now.
When it comes to the crunch.
You know what I mean? He's won like 3 Serie A titles. He's won a Premier League title. He's now won a European Championship. He's going to stay with Italy for the foreseeable future. Obviously, this is the sort of golden generation. I don't know, in the World Cup in 18 months, how many of these players are still going to be in the team.
That's the thing. We might have just seen the last of...
Bonucci's 34, Chiellini's 36, so Chiellini would be 37 and a half, but I think he can still do a job.
Well, his game's not dependent on pace, is it? It's like it's like Pepe. Like, he's still a top-class defender. I know he's a bit erratic, but he's like 40.
Yeah,
he's still
doing a good players, job. So. They can read the game. Like, these centre-backs, that, you know, like Maldini, he was never quick, but he could read the game. Do you know what I mean? You had so many players.
I think we'll see Chiellini next year, man.
Yeah, that's what Chiellini was saying in his post-match, when he was just like, I wanted to be like Materazzi, and saying, like, he was just really...
Cannavaro,
well, yeah. He was just saying, like, you know, oh, man, like, he's a leader. He's a leader. He really, really is. So I'll go over our sort of Euro best 11. This is what we put on Instagram. So there's been some controversy about me picking Jan Sommer, the Swiss keeper, in there. But I've got a few subs as well.
I'm looking at this, and bearing in mind from what we've been talking about, this is a bit of a mad team, especially in goal and up front.
Yeah, in goal and up front. Sommer. 21 saves in the tournament, highest by 3 by any other goalkeeper. He had that fantastic game against France. You know, if you basically keep out the world champions, obviously he conceded 3 goals in that game, but, you know, it would have been a hell of a lot more. And he made those great penalty saves, and generally just had a really, really good tournament for the Swiss, who went a lot deeper than anybody would have imagined. So that's why he gets the place for me. Donnarumma put on the bench. On the bench for this team, and potentially Pickford as well, because I think all 3 of those have been fantastic. As you alluded to, the striker. Who else would you put there? Patrick Schick scored 5 goals for the Czech Republic.
You know, that's a good shout. You know, I didn't realise he'd scored that many. But I think, you know, in that position...
Joint scorer with Cristiano Ronaldo. And you can't put Cristiano in there.
I was just about to say, I probably would put Ronaldo in there.
He scored 3 penalties and 2 tap-ins.
Yeah, but don't worry about that, man. It's leadership quality, bro. We've been talking about this the whole thing.
You're talking about, like, basically, Euro best 11 is, like, for me, it's like overachievers. It's a team of overachievers, essentially.
Well, that's a different way to start the thing altogether, isn't it? Like, if we're talking about overachievers, I'd have Imbolo in there for Switzerland, man.
Yes, that's why I said he had a good tournament. So we've gone for a 4-3-3. We've got Sommer in goal, Maguire and Chiellini as his centre backs, which you can't argue with, surely. Shaw at left back. Joachim Mahler, who was a left back, but he's naturally a right back.
You're squeezing him in.
He's right footed, so I squeeze him on the right side.
Fair enough.
Because I put Kyle Walker on the bench, but I didn't really see him as being like a tournament best. Obviously, he didn't concede a goal from open play, which is a great achievement. So, but you can't put the whole England back line in there, can you?
as much as we'd like to.
My forward three would be Patrick Schick as a central player. Sterling has to get in there, I think, even though he didn't have a great game in the final, he was still fantastic. And Chiesa, who did have a very good game in the final, gets there on the right side.
Yeah, I like that.
And midfield three of Pedri, who had some mad stats, like most successful passes in the middle and attacking third, most incisive passes, highest percentage of completed. It was some he had just some mad stats. They're in there, somewhere in the sun. But like, as an 18-year-old, you know, and he got to the semi-final.
He's only 18, yeah, Jesus. Yeah.
So fantastic. So he gets in there. It was either Verratti or Jorginho. One of those Italian midfielders had to get in there. I've gone for Verratti because I think he's a little bit more on the front foot. I think he got a couple of assists. He had a lot of sort of incisive passes. So he's a little bit more on the front foot than Jorginho. He's a bit little bit more defensive, sits in the hole. So I put Verratti in there just because I think he offers a little bit more going forward. And De Bruyne, I think, was fantastic until they got knocked out.
The only reason I'd go against De Bruyne, not because of what he did, because what he did was, with the little time he had, was phenomenal. I just don't think he played enough.
Yeah. Really. Who would you put in there instead?
That's what I'm thinking of now. Yeah. It's hard to... Because all things being even and him playing every minute, obviously he goes in there and he showed what he can do. But
Calvin Phillips, my argument that he was good enough to get into a Euro best 11.
He hasn't got that passing range, has he, man? Because you've got Verratti in there in that central role.
I mean, I was changing it for weeks. Like, obviously, Pogba was another one that you could have put in there.
Yeah, Pogba.
But they went out pretty early as well.
Kante was in there, but he's a bit more of a defensive mould as well. But
Renato Sanchez, I had in there for a while.
Yeah, depends what you want to do. I've got no real problem with De Bruyne. Like, we all know how good he is and all that.
So. And then, obviously, I think Modric was quality. They went out quite early, but I think he was brilliant throughout the tournament. You had Zuba as a left-back, the Swiss left-back. He got 4 assists. He got the most assists.
Mad.
So, fair play to him. So there's some definite honourable mentions there. Robin Gosens for Germany, who was great up until obviously he got knocked out by England. Denzel Dumfries in the right back position. He would have been in there had he not got knocked out in the last 16 because he got goals and assists.
I'm screwing Portugal went out just because of how good Bernardo Silva was playing, man. He was wicked to watch, man. So screwing Portugal went out early.
And obviously Emil Forsberg, I think he can fill the Swedish attacking midfielder because he scored three or four goals and he hit the woodwork like two or three times as well.
Good shout.
And they went out quite early, Sweden, didn't they? So what was it? The quarterfinals, they went out. So, yeah, that was it. I think that's kind of the end of our sort of Euro chat, really. We'll talk about sort of like some of the fantastic key moments, like such as, you know, just as an overview, like I say fantastic key moments. We'll just stick to key moments because the first one's pretty grim, isn't it? Obviously, with what happened to Christian Eriksen, which feels like a lifetime ago now.
I know, yeah. It was only like 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah, like, well, I think how long's the tournament on for? 5 weeks. Yeah, so I think it's like 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Madness, that is.
So it's so long ago, and then obviously you had that great Manic Monday with the 2-3-3.
Yeah, that was mad. And a part of that as well, Pogba's goal. That's goal of the tournament, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
got to
be
up there. That was outrageous. That was absolutely outrageous.
I think that there was a Lorenzo Insigne one against Belgium was pretty special as well. And then obviously you had the final, like, you know, and I suppose as you say, like England getting deep into these tournaments keeps us sort of like engaged and keeps us like talking about it, and it sort of contributed to like this podcast as well, because like if England had gone out, it kind of would have been like a 10 minute little gambit on the Euros, wouldn't it? Well, and we'd probably been in final, other things to talk about.
A nice little hipster's pick though, Switzerland Turkey, their final group game, that was what was it, like 3-2 or 3-all or something, and he's full of absolute screamers.
Shaqiri was going on mad.
So there was a lot of nuggets in that tournament. Is the most I've enjoyed football in a long time, and for that I'm grateful. So absolutely sweet. And the World Cup's only next year. What is it, November, December time next year? The boys are going to be playing in Qatar, touch wood.
18 months away, so it's going to come up, it's going to come around real quick. Obviously we're going to have a Premier League season in between there, then we're going to have another start to a Premier League season, and then it'll be in between the season, so it'll it will be very, very strange. It'll be a completely different sort of dynamic to football, you know, next year. Obviously, with Qatar being so hot, then they've had to do it in set. I guess that's the reason why, isn't it?
I imagine. I
mean, it's like 45 degrees in the summer or something.
I thought they were going to have like some air conditioning type stuff going on, because they have like inside snow ramps and everything in Saudi. So I was thinking, why would they be able to sort something out like that for the footy? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, even then though, you know, it'd be torture to put someone through a football game in that heat.
It's still rough, yeah.
All right, so we've got a quick Open Golf preview that I recorded yesterday, so we'll quickly go over that, and then we'll get into the combat sports. So here is a quick review of the 149th Open. So the 149th British Open starts tomorrow at Royal St George's as Shane Lowry bids to defend his title after winning the Claret Jug in Northern Ireland last year for his maiden major victory. That was actually the first time an Open Championship had taken place in Northern Ireland for 68 years, but the location of this year's event returns to familiar territory for the 15th time at the course in Sandwich, Kent. So what are the keys to victory this week? So good ball strikers will be an advantage, undulating greens, so the best putters will be at a huge advantage, Some key stats for Royal St George's. Let's take a look at the most important metrics at Royal St George's and determine which golfers boast top marks in each category over the last 24 rounds. So this should be a good starting point for us to build our and our betting approach. So strokes gained, approach play. The most important statistic this week is going to be strokes gained and the approach play. Royal St George's is a relatively short and strategic course, and golfers with all types of skill sets should be in play. The one statistic that golfers cannot compete without this week is strong approach play. With deep greenside bunkering and difficult green complexes, a slight misfire on approach can cause significant problems. So total strokes gained and approach in the past 24 rounds. Colin Morikawa, plus 41.6. Emiliano Grillo, 27.8. Daniel Berger, 26.0. Paul Casey, 25.9. And Rory McIlroy, 24.5. So it just gives you an idea of which golfers are doing well in that department. Secondly, strokes gained, ball striking. So Royal St. George's is most definitely a ball striker's course. Usually the more difficult an event plays, the more emphasis on ball striking. I expect this event to be quite difficult. In the 14 Open Championships at the course, all the winners beside one, Greg Norman in 1993, have finished with a winning score of 5 under or worse. So total strokes gained, ball striking in the past 24 rounds. Colin Morikawa up there again, plus 56.7. Brooks Koepka, plus 40.4. Victor Hovland, plus 34.6. Sergio Garcia, 34.4. And Daniel Berger, 34.2. So Daniel Berger in there again. Strokes gained tee to green in windy conditions. So wind is always going to be a factor when playing in an Open Championship. Golfers will need to control distance and trajectory while battling a difficult coastal wind. So total strokes tee to green, windy conditions in the past 24 rounds. John Rahm, plus 60.1. Dustin Johnson, 53.5. Corey Connors, 50.0. Emiliano Grillo, 49.9. Colin Morikawa, 47.3. Okay, so let's look at three golfers really that I want to focus on this week in the betting department. So these three golfers are within the most top 10 finishes. All of them have 7. I think this season, the top golfer with 11 is John Rahm. And then three of these golfers that I'm about to mention here are have been, you know, consistently good throughout the course of the season. So the first one, as you know, big mention there in those three statistics that we just spoke about, Colin Morikawa. He's tied third with 7 top 10 finishes. His odds this week are 33-1. Definitely has the skills in his locker to be in contention come Sunday, and that's reflected in being in the top 5 of all these data collections by the Chicago Tribune. So they rate him in the last 24 rounds as being a golfer that has potential to be in the mix come Sunday. So excellent strike with the ball, very adept in windy conditions from tee to green, and impressive approach play, so he will be one to watch for sure. And more of an outsider one is Corey Connors. So he's tied third with 7 top 10 finishes as well this season. His odds are 100-1. So it'll be interesting to see how he plays coming into this, because he's had a couple of outings that haven't been great over the past sort of 4 or 5 in the last couple of months. But before then, you know, he was cut in the US Open last month, but he had a good go at the Masters, finished tied for 8th. Has had good placings at the Players and the Arnold Palmer Invitational. I think he came 4th in one, 3rd in the other. He also likes playing when he's striking up a gale. So a huge prize, 100-1 at the time of recording this. I've had a cheeky each way on him to get a top 10 finish. And lastly, another player that has played some of the best golf of his life, basically, same as the Canadian Corey Connors, Harris English. He's also had 7 top 10 finishes with 2 wins on the tour this year. At a price of 66-1, he's good value. He won the Travelers and Century Tournament and finished 3rd in last month's US Open, so he's hot. The 31-year-old is having a breakthrough season in his career and is a very consistent putter, which is going to be very important on these undulating greens at St. George's this week. He has got a knack for sinking long putts as well, with him being seventh on the average distance a putt made on the PGA circuit. So puts him in a great contention for a top 10 finish if his approach play to the green and fairway percentage are firing on all cylinders. He has only failed to make the cut on four occasions this season, and I think Morikawa on only three occasions. So these guys, you know, they will give you a good run for your money, hopefully. Let us know on Instagram or let us know on Twitter if you've had a tickle, and good luck. And let us know who else you're backing, who you fancy. You can tell me I'm completely wrong, but should be a great weekend. Really, really looking forward to it. So I'll pass you on to Jim for the combat sports.
It's quite disconcerting to hear your voice from the past there, basically introducing me, but thanks very much. And for the combat sports this week, it's going to be, I don't want to say one-dimensional, but I just want to focus on UFC 264, the main event primarily. Just a quick overview of the undercard. Sean O'Malley, Tai Tuivasa and Gilbert Burns all picked up wins on the undercard, but the headliner, the rubber match between Dustin Poirier and Conor McGregor, was all I was interested in beforehand, and it unfolded. It was more spectacular in a sense, way more surprises than I would have thought, and, you know,
because you were really interested in the dynamic in the press conferences and the sort of mental aspect and how sort of like McGregor was manipulating him and trying to like baiting him into these sort of like bad habits and trying to get him to like sort of like jump.
And that manifested in an overarching way. It really consumed the event after the fight itself was done. So just to go through the build-up, as you alluded to, McGregor got nasty, issuing death threats, insulting Poirier's wife, and just generally indulging in his baser instincts. I saw flickers of Poirier's annoyance, and I was intrigued to see if that would build into something reckless in the fight. But as soon as the first bell rang, the early blitz from McGregor that we knew was coming, that his whole game plan is dependent upon, in him establishing dominance and asserting himself into the fight. A lot of kicks, a lot of spinning kicks, kicks to the body. And it wasn't long before he mixed in that famous left hand and caught Poirier flush. But Poirier responded with his own combinations, and he actually hurt McGregor and forced him to clinch.
Don't you think there was an incredible amount of similarities between this and the fight in January in terms of how that first round panned out? There was a bit of tit for tat. McGregor, same again, had, I think it was either a left or right hand in January, caught Poirier. But he kind of like, same again, he didn't really shake him too much. And then he was able to like, you know, counteract that with like another sort of barrage of hits. And McGregor looked in trouble, like, you know, not in trouble, but he looked a little bit shook at times.
I think you bang on there. The main difference was the kicks from McGregor. We didn't see any kicks at all. Well, maybe one or two in the second round as a retaliation to Poirier's kicks. But in this, he wanted to make a point of saying, I'm not just going to box with you here. There is another threat coming from my feet, which...
Do you think that was working in the first round?
Well, I think it's always good to have more weapons in your arsenal. And in that respect, it did. But Poirier didn't seem particularly bothered by it. He was checking with his legs. He was catching on his elbows. He was staying out of range for the spinny stuff. And he knew the left hand was coming, as we all did. Like, Conor McGregor is not going to fight without throwing that left hand. And he had his own plan for when that came. So when McGregor landed that one left hand, that was supposed to be his building block to go on and get successes. But Poirier exchanged with him and hurt McGregor, forced him to clinch, pushed him up against the cage. And this is where the most unexpected aspect of the fight came, where Conor McGregor jumped into a guillotine choke. Now, just to break this down specifically but quickly, he had him on the right side. It's like a front headlock, a guillotine. And McGregor had him under his right arm, and to his left-hand side was the cage. To escape a guillotine, a real guillotine, you have to pass to that side that the cage was on. So giving McGregor all the credit in the world, I was wondering whether he went for that guillotine knowing the cage was there and knowing that Poirier, or thinking that Poirier wouldn't be able to escape. But here's where Poirier's grappling finesse and his knowledge comes in. He just adapted his technique to the situation. He still managed to go into full guard, take the pressure off the guillotine, and then he passed over to that side, walking his legs up the cage, and still passed to that side. So he was not to be denied. And then after he passed the guard, he was raining punches down, elbows. He absolutely smashed him when
those
he was on the ground.
Those elbows look nasty. Yeah. Like, seriously nasty. My thinking was, like, obviously there was a clear difference in terms of their grappling abilities. So it was surprising to me to see McGregor want to get down to the mat as soon, you know, as early in that round, because it was always going to be a danger. Like, all right, if there's 30 seconds left, you know, if you can make a move like that, try and finish him off with a guillotine with 30 seconds left, then all right, if it doesn't go right, you're not going to have to deal with him too much, you know, on the ground.
Yeah, it might have been that he was thinking, I'm going to get taken down here anyway, and there was something he wanted to throw up. But again, giving him all the credit in the world, I do think there was a positional element to that, and I think he threw it up.
So it's probably a smart play.
I think so, but well, smart in the sense of Poirier's probably not expecting this. But Poirier is a very good grappler, and as I say, the way to get that is to go across to the opposite side of the body to escape that guillotine, and he didn't even care that the cage was there. He just walked his feet up and just stayed there until the grip went up. Then he smashed, passed, and then McGregor's legs were pinned together on his side. He's taking elbows, he's taking punches. It was a very bad position. And then the little retaliations that McGregor did offer, he landed a few very nice elbows from the bottom. And then he landed an up kick as well. So he's on his back on the mat, and then he kicked upwards at Poirier. And then Poirier let him up, and it later emerged that Poirier was complaining that McGregor was holding the inside of his glove, and that's illegal. So he's pulling him down with his glove and kicking up into his face. And Poirier appealed to the ref to say, look, this is what he's doing, he's fouling me here. McGregor used that split second to spring to his feet while Poirier took his eye off him. It was not even half a second, which shows you McGregor was using everything he could to his advantage in that fight. But then they exchanged left hands again. I think McGregor threw another kick, then threw another left hand, then he planted his foot. And I thought Poirier landed a punch that put him down, but it turned out the bone at the bottom of his shin had snapped in two. And then the fight went on for like another 20 seconds to the end of the round with Poirier again punching down on him against the cage, elbows again. And you're thinking McGregor's in real trouble here. It only emerged after the round ended where McGregor's pointing to the ref and saying, look at my foot. Then all the medical staff came in. Then the fight was ended. He couldn't continue that. That is a horrific injury.
Yeah, because obviously the freeze frames that we look at after the fight are horrendous. But we don't see that in real time, do we? A lot of times. Obviously, it happened with Michael Chandler. Was it Michael Chandler?
No, it was...
Who was it?
Chris Weidman.
Yeah, that happened a few months ago, didn't it?
Yeah, and then obviously the Anderson Silva was another famous example. There's been a lot of theories thrown about when did the crack happen. You see Poirier, he checks one particularly hard kick and he points at him and says, I know that was a good check, I know that hurt you. Another one he caught on his elbow. Look, that could have happened anywhere in the fight. It doesn't really matter, to be honest. It's just a horrific injury that comes from hitting things really hard with your bones.
And it was obviously the adrenaline, the pain doesn't set in with all that adrenaline by the looks of it, because, you know, it was crazy that, you know, McGregor was shouting. He was shouting across to Dustin Poirier, saying, "It weren't the check. That wasn't what did it." Kind of thing.
You never check one of those. He's berating the ref as well. That's not a stoppage. So after the fight, this is where the psychological aspect comes back into play. Poirier, his frustration was still palpable. He was calling McGregor a bitch ass on the floor. He's like, what are you doing? He's like, he basically believed at the end that he checked out of the fight, that he didn't want any more of it. And you know what? I won't blame him for thinking it. In his post-fight interview with Joe Rogan, he said, look, he's grabbed me inside my gloves. He's a dirtbag. He's like, I don't expect anything more or less from him. He's an absolute dirtbag. I just expect this from him. 2-1, and he's like, this is job done. And then they chose to interview McGregor when he was on the floor. Now, you might have mixed feelings, what I certainly do. Do you want to interview this guy who's just snapped his leg in two? His adrenaline's running, his frustration's on top, his pain, his anguish, it's all, and a lot of ugly.
But I mean, funny, but that's what most of people pay for, you know,
exactly.
The pay-per-views. And I think Rogan and like the whole of the UFC probably know that. But for me, it's like, it doesn't make any sense, man. I think, you know, we don't really want to see that. Like, I don't know. For me, it's like, It felt a bit more like a show than an actual, you know, a combat arena. And obviously, I was impressed with Poirier and the way he came across in his post-match. You know, he was very humble. You know, he was sort of like, he was giving shout-outs to, like, disabled kids that were from Lafayette. You know, from I think his Louisiana, his hometown.
There's a cancer patient in there, so his foundation was working to help this kid who was fighting cancer. He was in the arena. He's like, look, I can stop this whenever I want. You're fighting cancer all day, all night. So
I think it was a great sentiment. And you also told all the fans booing him to kiss his old asshole, which I thought was quite cool.
Like McGregor's pointing his fingers to his head as if I'm going to kill you. This isn't over. If I see you outside in the street, it's on. your wife's in me DMs, baby. Come to the after party. It's like, his legs in a splint. It's snapped in two. He's scuttling on his ass across the canvas to abuse Poirier and his wife even more. He completely...
Strange.
He completely gave in to the malice that was bubbling underneath. As I said to you, he was like the picture of Dorian Gray.
He clearly must hate him, or he builds this like mental prison in his own mind where he's just like... He doesn't let any sort of like, you know, anything else like consume him apart from the fact that he needs to win this fight, or he needs to like almost make like this show out of it. I don't know. It's a very strange kind of approach. I feel like
it's not as if you dominated the first round. It's as if he's believing his own hype from about 6 years ago. He's almost
delusional. Like.
Yeah. Well, like look, he's a very good fighter, and I've been a fan of him for a long time. But what I've seen in the aftermath of that fight. I'm done with him, man. I've seen flickers of it before the Khabib fight, where he was going on like some coke-fueled maniac, talking about Dagestanis are cowards, all my Chechen brothers. You're talking about things you don't know anything about. You're just trying to, and insulting his religion, saying, why don't you take a drink? It's like, you know why he doesn't take a drink? He's Muslim, he don't drink.
Yeah.
So what are you trying to bring into play here? A lot of ugliness there. I'm willing to overlook that kind of thing, because when you get dragged into a particularly nasty rivalry, things like that do happen. But what did Poirier do to him? Like, and when you consider how nice he was in the build-up to the second fight, like how nice he was, oh, well done, like respect, give me a bit of your hot sauce, I'll donate to your charity. And then he switches it around saying, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to bang your wife. Which one's real?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Do you either one of these or you're not? And it's like, on one hand, are these just samurai tactics where you use everything you can to your advantage? Or is he just a piece of shit?
Like? Yeah, is he just a bit nuts and a bit, like, and actually kind of like a bit of an arsehole, like, because... I just think they're stepping over the mark with like saying like, oh, he's going to leave in a casket, and you know he's going to leave as a cold dead body, and you know, and then at the end of the fight, like sticking his gun to his head. And you alluded to earlier, like you were saying, like he's from Dublin, man.
Yeah, people get shot in Dublin for jokes. Like
a place in the world where like, you know, that is an actual threat.
Yeah,
and McGregor has a large following and a lot of people that
and a lot of money.
Yeah, that really do follow him and sort of like, you know. He's kind of almost like, you know, a demigod stem, do you know what I mean?
He's inciting some real nasty stuff there. And, you know, he really is like Mike Tyson. If you examine Tyson in his younger days, very eloquent, there's a lot of meanness there, but there's also a lot of charm. But then when he got to the mid to late 90s, he was just spiraling into this world of his own ego, of money, of surrounded by sycophants and believing his own hype, and I'm going to destroy you. And I'm like, look, man. Father time gets everyone, and you can't fight that stuff. You either adapt or just accept, and that's the only thing you can do, man. And he's still clinging on to this Mystic Mac when he was down at featherweight, blitzing people out, and he's a tremendous fight. He's not that guy anymore. And hey, Poirier is, if they fight again, Poirier will tool him up again, man.
Because he's, you know, he's 32 now. He's got to have minimum 6 weeks.
He's medically suspended till next year.
So there you go. So he's not going to be ready to fight until mid next year at the earliest, which would then he'd be 33. He's already lost back to back to Poirier, who's clearly a better fighter, clearly much more well mentally and physically prepared. Like where does he, you know? And he's already retired twice. He's made 120 million last year alone. He's made 3.1 million from this fight. Like, he doesn't need to fight anymore.
Well, you know what? Khabib smashed it. And I know Khabib's not exactly unbiased because the ugliness that happened between them two. But McGregor perpetuated all that. But regardless, he said about McGregor, look, you can fight guys like Donald Cerrone and you can look like a lion and make money. But when you fight guys like Dustin Poirier, Justin Gaethje, like Michael Chandler, Charles Oliveira, you're going to know your level when you fight those guys. And it's all up to him. He's going to carry on making money. Khabib was even giving him full benefit of the doubt. Like, he's like, I support trash talk up to a certain level. You have to make money. You have to get interest on it. He's like, I understand that. But you don't talk about people's wives. You don't talk about people's fathers, their religions.
Like a moral code of conduct.
What you want, like, yeah. And then it really, I don't want to say, like, Poirier put it perfectly himself. He said, karma's not a bitch. Karma's a mirror. And then you look at what's happened. He said, Poirier, you're gonna get carried out in a stretcher. McGregor got carried out in a stretcher. And he's like, the first one to shoot is a bitch. McGregor was the first one who tried to clinch. McGregor was saying beforehand, I don't count submissions. He's the one that went for a guillotine. Come on, man. It's all these mad little idiosyncrasies that happened in the fight. And I'm just thinking, I don't want to seem like I'm off the McGregor bandwagon just because he lost. I don't really care if he lost. I didn't care that he lost against Poirier in January. I do not like, I don't agree with the way he was behaving after the fight. Beforehand, okay, I could understand, even though he did go a bit too far, he's getting under his skin, he's trying to get an advantage. There's no need for all that stuff after the fight, man. No need whatsoever.
All right, so let's talk about, I think we generally covered most of that. Do you want to talk about Sean O'Malley? You got anything on that?
Well, he just beat up like a kid called Chris Moutinho, who looked about two weight classes below him. And he was hitting him with everything he could. And he still didn't. They stopped him on his feet. So, like, either... Like, obviously, O'Malley's got real power.
With only about 30 seconds like left to go, do you reckon Herb Dean had, like, it to go within the distance?
Or... yeah, maybe. But he took a lot of punishment. Yeah. And I don't think it benefits Sean O'Malley to be given matchups like this. To be given against a smaller guy who's technically fairly limited, who's not offering much by way of an attacking game. Yeah, I think they're basically... protecting their investment. I think Sean O'Malley has got a lot of commercial viability and you can't jeopardise that by putting him in against people like Chico Vera, who's already beaten him, against guys, even like Cody Garbrandt, who's on the way down. To be fair, I think Sean O'Malley might beat Cody Garbrandt, but it speaks volumes to me. That...
Yeah, because Rob Font beat him last time out, didn't he? I think Rob Font was really impressive, so I'm looking forward to him next time out.
Rob Font versus Sean O'Malley, great fight. Someone who's technically sound, got a high guard, great jab.
I don't think Sean O'Malley's ready for that, though.
And that's the thing, they're putting him in these prominent positions on Conor McGregor cards. You got to be ready for these fights, man.
I think, is that his first showing on a main card?
No, he's been on there before, but they put him up there because of his commercial appeal, because of his presence online, because of his videos, his Instagram, all this, and his fighting style, let's not get it twisted. He does have a spectacular fighting style, but I think there are practical, unspectacular ways to undermine that style and to beat that style. Mm-hmm. So I think they're protecting him to a certain degree. I'm happy to be proven wrong. If he smokes Cody Garbrandt, if he comes back and he fights like Corey Sandhagen and TJ Dillashaw when they fight on the 24th of July, if he mixes it in there and proves me wrong, I ain't got no problem with that at all. But as of yet, it's like, who have you beaten, really?
Yeah. So about a quick review of sort of the general of the fights, like Gilbert Burns.
That was a bit of a dry one. I thought Stephen Wonderboy Thompson was going to win that fight, and Burns just... He just took him down and controlled him there. Something that sounds pretty simple, but no one's been able to do to Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. So now he's... put himself back in the mix for another title shot against Usman. I think Usman's supposed to be fighting Kobe Covington this year. Leon Edwards again missing out on a title fight. Ridiculous.
What is that all about? The Brummie.
Yeah, the Brummie. Yeah. From up the road, man. Yeah, I don't
know. And he beat, who did he beat last time out?
Nate Diaz.
What does he need to do to get shot?
I have no idea. Kobe Covington hasn't fought in like a year or something.
It should be like periods of inactivity. They should mean nothing. If you're out there risking your record to get a shot at the title, you should be the one that gets priority, man. Not guys that have like been inactive for like over 12 months and like, you know, just basically biding their time for a big shot. Like, give this guy a fucking chance, man.
And I've talked about the UFC a lot of time as more of a meritocracy, but it's looking a bit like the other way. It's looking a bit more like boxing nowadays. But I think we've gone long enough on that now. I think. But it was a good entertaining card overall. McGregor, I think I'm done with him pretty much. That's the takeaway from this, man. He's not for me to be disappointed. But I was thinking, you've just evolved into the worst version of yourself here.
Yeah.
But again, you do have to give some consideration to the context. He's in a lot of pain. Frustration,
but he was doing that.
He was like, doing it before
when he was perfectly exactly. calm and measured. He was saying, you know, the same sort of rhetoric. So, I don't think it. I don't think it improves the quality of the sport. And for me, it doesn't make me want to watch the sport if there's more of that. So, yeah, he doesn't really. I think people like sort of Rob Font, who are very, you know, sort of down to earth, they make me want to watch the sport. And you know, people like Dustin Poirier, and even you know Sean O'Malley, he's got a particular personality. He's got a bit of spice to him, but he's always very respectful.
Yeah, isn't it? It doesn't take it too far. But even afterwards, after the Chris Moutinho fight, he was going saying some mad things about, oh, I've just told him up. I've just battered him basically. And it's like, mate, you're supposed to batter him. Yeah. Don't brag about doing something you're supposed to be doing.
No, but he was saying as well, he was saying like he's a warrior, man. He was a warrior and like, you know, just sort of like, you know, he deserves like chances in the future and stuff like, which is, you know,
yes,
fair enough.
That's nice. Yeah. I didn't see that, to be fair, but yeah.
No, but yeah, that was a great episode. Like, great to talk about the end of the Euro 2020s. You know, getting the conversation on both sides of the spectrum, on the field and off the field, about what's happened. It's been like a crazy 6 weeks, really. Like, yeah. A really busy, like, sport-filled, you know, 6 weeks, and like obviously we're gonna have a little bit of a downtime now. Obviously we've got the Open starting today, which is gonna be interesting to watch for me over the weekend. But apart from that, boxing UFC wise, what's the on the horizon?
Corey Sandhagen, TJ Dillashaw on the 24th. Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder has been pushed back to October because Fury tested positive for COVID.
When's that circus between Woodley and?
Oh, that's August.
Woodley and Jake Paul.
That's late August as well. That might be the 24th as well. But yeah, all coming in the next month. It's not a packed schedule, but there's always something on the weekend. So we'll be mining that out week after week for sure.
All right, thanks for listening. As always, give our podcast a listen on Spotify and all the places that you listen. Make sure you check us out on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and we'll see you next week. See you next week, Jim.
Pleasure as always, sir.